Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. I'm busy dropping the ball. Forgot to call our guest. Oops.
Oh, what the heck?
As the music starts, I'm like, oh, whoops, we forgot.
We talked about this, remember?
We've had 2 weeks. Sorry, we had guest failure the last couple of weeks. Just people were busy, stuff going on, so we had to abdicate. Anyway, today would be November 28th, believe it or not, 2021. We've almost put another idiotic year in the... We thought last year was the idiotic year.
Yeah, this year.
Now we're almost done with the second idiotic year.
This year was the rerun.
Rerun of last year's idiotic year. Before we do our sponsor and all that, I just want you to write down the new name of the new fake virus that we have or whatever it is.
The one that gives you a stuffy nose?
The one that gives
I'm
you...
I'm terrified.
No, I think it makes
myself.
You cough. It gives you sniffles and a cough or something.
Oh, and a cough.
And it's O-M-I-C-R-O-N, right? Letter in the Greek alphabet. But if you're into anagrams, you might not... Well, if you're into anagrams, you already figured it out. But if you're not into anagrams, you just rearrange those letters. And oddly enough, it spells moronic. So we have now entered the new moronic variant. And you heard it here first.
But the good news is they're going to have a vaccine for that in 2 weeks.
Is it called Smartness?
Yeah.
We're going to have a Smartness vaccine.
Yay! They're going to want everybody to get it. It's been under, they've been researching it now for 3 weeks, and they'll have it ready.
Because they had a vision.
Yeah. And that's what
they'll stop your stuffy nose. Where's that been my whole life?
I know it.
For heaven's sake, I can stop taking allergy pills. So anyway, my name is Aaron Ryan.
I don't think anybody figured that out yet. My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pat Bay Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pat Bay Machinery is everything John Deere green. You need a tractor, a mower, attachments. Go up and see them. They've got it all in stock. Got a pretty good inventory right now. They've also got a fully staffed shop and parts department. So if you need parts or service, go up and talk to them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226. They'll be there all week. This was kind of a short week, this Thanksgiving week, but next week will be a full week for them, so get up there and get your John Deere stuff all lined out for Christmas. They're also a Steel Power Products and a Honda dealer, so they've got some generators in stock. They've got some steel products up there if you want to put some of that under the tree. Or give them or stop by the website. At
theoldwebsite.com.
Yeah, theoldwebsite.com, papaymachinery.com.
There you go. And so while we're doing everything backwards, we're like contraries. Wash with dirt. Does that go?
while Nero fiddles.
Nothing's burning, though.
Like, yeah, that's
kinda,
true.
Kinda
not yet.
You're about a month behind. Hey, I just wanted to let people know you can always find everything on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. So you have links to a lot of things, books and all sorts of stuff. And you also have show archives that are on there with no commercials. Not that we don't love the advertisers, but there are no commercials in there. So that'll save you a little bit of time. They're an MP3 file, so you can, you know, download them or share them or do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Also on the front page, you will see that there is a new website, not the We the People website, but there's another one. It's called My Place on the Wall, and the web address for that is myplaceonthewall.com. Because if we're going to defend the Republic, everyone's going to have to take their place on the wall, so you better figure out what yours is. And some of what needs to be done is people need to pipe up a little bit more. I know there's a big push to silence everyone, but they can only silence you if you stop talking. That is a website where you can post video, you can post articles, you can start a blog, you can connect with other people. It's sort of in the format of Facebook, has nothing to do with Facebook. The only administrator on the site would be yours truly. Listed there as John Galt because I just, you know, I'm an Atlas Shrugged fan. If you've never read it, you should get with that. if they're going to lock you in your house, make sure you have a copy of Atlas Shrugged. It'll keep you busy for a while. Anyway, it's a place where people can share quite a bit. I know they're putting up a lot of information about the vaccine and things like that that are getting taken down off Facebook. So there is zero moderation on that website. And if you read something you don't like, please comment to the person who posted it, because it will not be taken down. Unless, of course, you know, it's, you know, mean pictures about puppies or something like that. So.
Oh, so you do have limits.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to. Yeah. If you're going to abuse puppies or, you know, do something else ridiculous, we'll have to take that down. But for your opinion, you can have your opinion there. Isn't that nice? Imagine that. Oh. So my phone is back in the room. Travis scurried it back in, which means he called Dr. Pry, who is patiently waiting. And sorry about that. I forgot to give him the number when we got here. Oh, these things. You know, you make these great plans. I actually called him and double-checked, made sure we were on for today, and then, you know, fumbled the ball. That's what happens when I have too much time on my hands. Our guest today, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, has been with us before, and I have listed shows that he has done with us before because they are chock full of information. There's also quite a bit of information on the site about the things we're going to discuss, but he's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both of those are congressional advisory boards. He also serves on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and the House Armed Services Committee. Dr. Pry was an intelligence officer with the CIA, and he was responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. He has a PhD in history and archaeology and another one in strategic studies, which led him to the CIA. He's the author of numerous books, The War to Save America, Apocalypse Unknown, and I have those kind of on the bottom of the page for today. Blackout Warfare, The Power and the Light, Blackout Wars, The Manhattan Project. So there's some great stuff, and he is a terrific researcher and a super smart guy, and we love having him on. We always learn a lot. So I have posted Dr. Pry. I posted for today's deal Operation Dragon, Inside the Kremlin's Secret War on America, and then the second book by Molly Hemingway called Rigged. So...
Okay.
We're set.
Well, I'm gonna break my word to you and start off by talking about another book.
Nice.
Because I just finished watching The Last of the Mohicans.
Oh yeah, great
movie.
Thanksgiving weekend, James Fenimore Cooper's classic work. Great movie. Though I would recommend everybody to read the actual book. And if you ever get a chance to visit Cooperstown, New York, it brought back memories of when I was elementary school in Cooperstown is in, I lived in upstate New York, or really geographically, it's the central New York. You know, everything in New York is described relative to its location to New York City, which is, they refer to upstate New York when, in fact, geographically, the town of Marcy and Utica is right smack dab in the center of New York. It's central New York State. And Cooperstown was, less than a day's drive. You know, it was a little south of us in an area called the Southern Tier, which is still, not well developed. It's just, small towns and hamlets. Cooperstown is, I don't even think it qualifies as a city. Most people know of it because of the baseball museum, which is in Cooperstown. What most people talk about it, but it has the home of James Fenimore Cooper, you can still visit his home and see various things that he collected, there when he was writing in the early 19th century. And his novels, he wrote more than The Last of the Mohicans. He wrote a whole bunch of books. They're all fiction, but loosely based on what life was like on what was then the American frontier, which was central New York State. You know, people find it hard to imagine of New York as being the frontier, but it was back in those days. And as you can see from the movie The Last of the Mohicans, for example, it talks about the French and Indian War, being fought basically in central New York State, around Lake George is where most of the action happens. There's a massacre in the film that that actually happened. In fact, the broad contours of the description are true. You know, they just have some fictional characters and a love story set against the backdrop. And that's true of a lot of Cooper's writings. I remember another one of his books, much less well known, is called The Wept of Wishtown Wish, which describes what it was like to be living in New England on the New England frontier, probably a century before the French and Indian War, in the late 1600s, and to be fighting off Indians. You know, most of the his novels involve good Indians, bad Indians, but, you know, the expansion of America, the settling of what was then the West, you know, which was, you know, like Central New York State. And, you know, the, so that's a, so if you ever get a chance to go to Cooperstown, New York, highly recommend it. You get to, they probably still have real rock candy, which was a candy that was around in the 1700s and 1800s. You know, it's basically crystallized sugar on a string, but very good, excellent. And you can get to see some oddities there, too. I believe when I was a kid, the Cardiff Giant was still on display, and they probably still have him at Cooperstown, New York. The Cardiff Giant was an enormous hoax. A farmer, you know, Darwinism had just broken onto the scene about, you know, how human beings had evolved from lower life forms. And a farmer in New York claimed to have come across a petrified man from an earlier time, and he had made a big concrete giant out in his field and was charging people money to see this wonder. And it got packed up, and it's probably still on display in Cooperstown, New York. The gullibility level of people. Well, I'm not going to condemn their gullibility in the 19th century. After all, people believe in more absurd things today.
I was just going to say.
But, you know, people are always perpetually gullible. There were people that were, well, call them scientific cults, for example, that were very popular. People who believed in the hollow earth theory, for example. You know, the idea that the world was really hollow and you could get inside it, if you could get to one of the poles, that you could probably get inside the hollow earth and that there would be, it would be, that was their version of going to the moon and discovering moon men. And,
well, now they think the earth is flat, so, again.
Right. So. You know, and the, and a lot of, what's the polite word for them? Utopian movements occurred as New York State got settled, and in the 19th century, it was like San Francisco and the Silicon Valley is today. You know, it, eventually, as the frontier got settled and they introduced canals and the railroad, you know, these were cutting-edge, high-tech things. Also, new ways of making money on Wall Street. You know, by stocks instead of actually working for money. Okay, people could shuffle paper and manipulate paper and make fortunes off of this paper, which most Americans didn't trust for good reason, and still don't trust today. But there was a time, and they believed in a lot of cutting edge causes. Some of them good, some of them bad. For example, I think in 1849, there was the first meeting of the early feminists for women's rights at Niagara Falls, New York. The abolitionist movement was extremely strong, and they had underground railroad, you know, people working in upstate New York against the slave movement. So, you know, a lot of the what was then considered far left, almost crazy ideas and things that were crazy, like as it happened. Not far from where I lived, there was a utopian colony called in Oneida, and where they basically tried to they rejected the idea of the nuclear family. And they, of course, this was dreamed up by a male minister, all right? and he rejected the idea of the nuclear family. A man could, they believed in free love. You know, you could live together in a commune and people could have sex with each other without being married. The children would be held in common, so they wouldn't have just two parents, but they'd be raised by everybody. And
like it isn't hard enough with two parents.
Right, exactly. Anyway, it only lasted one generation, as most of these utopian things do, and until it imploded. But one of the things that came out of it, because the way they supported themselves, was by making silverware. And to this day, you can buy a Knight of Silver. It's still an important company. One of the few things that's left in upstate New York that makes anything. And then, of course, the Mormons, you know, started in upstate New York. John Smith claimed to have discovered, tablets buried on Mount Cumorah and had an encounter with the angel Morani, who told him about, Christ coming to the New World and an ancient civilization that had existed at upstate New York and in North America, and again there was a sexually liberating aspect about it, at least for men, in that the idea was that you could live like the patriarchs of old Israel and have more than one wife. Somehow, almost all these millennialist movements in the 19th century had something to do with men being able to have sex with more than one partner or more than one woman, and it not being a bad thing, becoming part of a new religion. But
it was a new religion, all right.
Right, you know.
The kind your mother warned you about. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. Almost choked.
Yeah, don't do that.
I know. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I did.
It was Bill. Bill did it.
I was going to ask you with the paddle.
that's why I almost choked. Oh, my gosh. Well, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Colder, summer getting warmer, tidal wave come across the Mexican border. Why buy a gallon? It's cheaper by the barrel. Just don't get busted singing Christmas carols. That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride. Both ends of the ozone burning. Funny how the world keeps turning. Look, Ma, no hands. I love this American.
And we're back.
There you go.
Back to Cooperstown.
Well, the last thing I'll just say about Cooperstown, and I may have mentioned it already, is the journey there itself, if you cast your mind back to New York as being the frontier, you know, that at one time it was. It's not hard to imagine that when you travel to Cooperstown because, I mean, unlike downstate New York, the environs of New York City, upstate New York, you know, the travel, it's so out of the way. It's still so remote. It's still so unsettled. I mean, there's just little hamlets and villages. I'll bet the population probably hasn't grown that much since the early 19th century. So it's not hard to imagine, you know, going back to Cooperstown, the time when this was the frontier, and for America, and if one can afford to go there, given the way gas prices are going and everything else, you know, it might be worth an escape from these stressful, traumatic times to take a visit to American history, because we're all so
before they take it all down
consumed with worry about the direction this country is taking. And I guess we'll move on to the next topic, you know, which is Operation Dragon. The book I want, one of the books I wanted to talk about today, which in a ways is one of the most disturbing books I think anyone will ever read, because it really raises questions in one mind. Maybe the title for your show today should have been "The Rigging of America." The Rigging of America. You know, later we'll talk about the rigged elections, and I'm sure all of your listeners know about the rigged elections and have, and one hardly needs to be convinced that the elections were rigged. But the problem with our country goes back way before 2020, and this is one of the books that'll really shake your confidence in the honesty of our institutions and whether the federal government has ever been straight with the American people. Operation Dragon is written by my friend and former boss at the CIA, Jim Woolsey, in cooperation with Ion Pasipa, who was the head of Romanian intelligence when Romania belonged to the Warsaw Pact. And this is the first book ever written by a former director of Central Intelligence, a former head of a Western intelligence agency, in cooperation jointly with a former head of a Warsaw Pact from the Soviet sphere intelligence agency. And there's a lot in the book, but I think the most striking thing about the book, and the reason I wanted to talk about it today, is because we're just coming out of the Thanksgiving holiday. You know, in a nutshell, the book really makes a compelling case. I think they virtually prove the case that, yes, Khrushchev and the USSR did assassinate John F. Kennedy. It wasn't the CIA. It wasn't the organized crime, but the Soviets did it. And I find it enormously frustrating because, you know, in my gut, and I think any thinking American has probably suspected that all along, but we've been told by our government, because of the Warren Commission, that Oswald acted alone, that there was no evidence that that the Soviets were involved, when in fact there's really overwhelming evidence that the Soviets were involved when you read the book and you get it unpacked, and even just by common sense, some of the things that didn't have to be revealed. You know, what a coincidence, you know, that Oswald was a committed communist, and that he had been in the Soviet Union for months before he came over to the United States to assassinate Kennedy. And what a coincidence that the assassination happened not too long after Khrushchev's humiliation after the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, anybody who was just reading the newspaper headlines probably would have come to the conclusion that the Soviets must have done it. You know, but it took our own government intervening with the Warren Commission and all this, you know, BS to try to make the case that that no, Oswald acted on his own. It wasn't part of a larger Soviet conspiracy. And if they're going to lie to us about such a fundamental thing as that, if they have such trust, going back that long ago, okay, when America was a very different place, but still the government didn't trust the people enough and didn't trust the judgment of the people. Just how long has it been that that the ruling elites, you know, have been manipulating public opinion and manipulating the American people and lying to us and keeping the truth from us because they fundamentally don't trust us and see the American people as untutored troglodytes, you know, who can't be trusted with the truth. And I distinctly recall, even though I was only, how old was I, 1954, 63, so I was, 7 years old, but I still can remember. I remember this. I remember being really disappointed that when the assassination happened on the November 22nd, you know, it was heading up toward Thanksgiving. And usually, you know, I mean, this is a period of real celebration and family gatherings and everything. And it just ruined Thanksgiving. As the selfish little kid that I was, you know, I can remember being really disappointed that, you know, that the television, we only had three channels back in those days,
yep.
was full of nothing but the assassination, and that all Americans, including my parents, were just so downcast by what had happened that the celebration seemed to have been ruined. And then I remember actually seeing on TV, I remember distinctly, it was in the living room with my mother. I was playing some game on the floor, and she was ironing clothes. And I remember actually seeing on the TV Jack Ruby coming up and shooting Kennedy, or excuse me, shooting Oswald, so that Oswald was assassinated. And according to the book, that was, Ruby had connections to organized crime, and the organized criminals had connections back to Soviet intelligence services, and that too was part of the deal. And Woolsey and Pasipo make a really good case that the Soviets had arranged a massive disinformation campaign designed to come up with other theories, you know, so that they would not be blamed for the Kennedy assassination. And they named names and they named books, and a number of the books, you know, were written that came out. They were practically ready to go within a year after the assassination. That ended up blaming the CIA and the FBI or organized crime. And these books were written by people that Woolsey and Pasipa point out, we now know, had ties to the KGB and the Soviet intelligence services, and they were part of the useful idiot network of journalists and reporters and writers that were on the Soviet payroll or were agents of influence, you know, that the Soviets were able to use. And it was an incredibly successful disinformation campaign, and our government and our intelligence agencies have spent years, you know, going along with that cover-up. They point out in the book, we had a defector from Cuba, you know, about 15 years ago, who was working in the Cuban intelligence services in their his job. Cuba's equivalent of NSA. They were listening to television and radio broadcasts in the United States. And this guy remembers that he was given specific instructions, you know, to be monitoring the TV and radio broadcasts coming out of the Dallas, Texas region on the day before, the day during, and then the day after the assassination. Castro had arranged to have a on the day of the assassination to have a meeting with French journalists so that he could act all surprised and shocked in front of useful idiots from the West, useful reporters from the West, you know, as if he had no idea about what was happening, when in fact he was in on it. He was informed by the Soviets of the plan to kill Kennedy. So it's a book I highly recommend people read. There's more in it than the Kennedy assassination, but I think that is incredibly important. And the fact that the book has not gotten any publicity, most people don't even know of its existence, is just very disturbing to me. It shows the, you know, raises questions about how free are we really as a people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? How much information are we really allowed to get? The book can get published, but then its existence is basically, you know,
kind of kept secret.
Yeah, basically gets pushed off, and it should be making headlines in the New York Times and the Washington Post and all of the usual places. Why did our own government want to keep it secret? The theory in the book is that, and this is entirely plausible, you know, is that, you know, the Johnson administration didn't want to get in a war with the Soviet Union, a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And they thought that the American people couldn't be trusted with the truth, you know, that there would be a public outcry for revenge. And they're probably right about that, but that doesn't mean the public outcry would be such that the government would have to be forced to push the button. You know, it's ultimately up to them. They didn't want to be put in the politically embarrassing situation of having to explain, look, you know, there's other ways that we will try to get our revenge. And history kind of took its revenge because Khrushchev didn't, his career didn't survive the assassination attempt. And this wasn't the only assassination. When you read the book, you know, Khrushchev was very big on assassinating political opponents in the West and had done it more than once before the hit on Kennedy. And one of the reasons he did it was because he knew that his career was going to soon be over because the Politburo was so unhappy with the outcome of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev had led them into that. He was confident that he was going to be able to prevail and that they were going to be able to keep missiles in Cuba and that Kennedy didn't have the guts to get into a nuclear conflict over that, but he'd miscalculated because of the advantage that we had built up in intercontinental nuclear missiles. They had a big advantage when it came to theater nuclear missiles opposite NATO Europe. That's where Moscow thought World War III was going to be fought, in NATO Europe. He didn't think that it would get to such a crisis that would bring us to the brink of an intercontinental nuclear war. And there they were weak. They hadn't built up their forces to match ours, at that time. And so Khrushchev basically was taken out. Some people even think that his early demise was a punishment from the Politburo, you know, to eliminate him, for his failures. So that's the first thing I wanted to draw to your listeners' attention. You've got it in the title of your show today, Operation Dragon, by Jim Woolsey and Ian Pasipa. You know, definitely short. Not a long book, but definitely worth a read. It really raises these questions in one's mind and is great food for thought about, wow, just how long has the government been lying to us? Oh, the other thing about Johnson is, of course, Johnson did not like Kennedy or the Kennedy brothers, and he had started off and they didn't like him. The Kennedy New England establishment, the Northeast liberal establishment, did not like Johnson. He was an old-time Southern politician, a deeply corrupt politician, an anti-intellectual. He used to humiliate. This part isn't in the book, but I know this from other writings, that Johnson liked to, after he became president, he liked to humiliate the Harvard, Yale, Kennedy School-type advisors forcing them to talk to him while he went to the toilet in the bathroom. And he was that kind of a guy. He was hoping that he would be reelected and that he would become a great figure in history himself. And so he wanted to move away from the Camelot myth that the press was so fixated on, so that the folks focus would be on him, which is another reason he wanted to try to wrap up and sweep under the cover, the carpet, as it were, the Kennedy assassination, so that would not become the whole focus of his administration, and then another international crisis that he would have to deal with, and maybe not successfully. So
history has not
I will pause
not been kind
okay,
to him.
Sorry.
I was going to say, and history hasn't really been kind to him, because stories like that about all his crudeness and stuff are really pretty, those are pretty well publicized. I don't think I don't think anybody buried those stories. That seems to be the thing you think of when you, his name comes up. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be.
And how many of them are also, how true are some of them? You know, one has to wonder.
Well, that's true too.
We know they suppress lies to us about their political enemies, and the Northeast liberal establishment was never kind to Johnson. They hated him. And so, you know, maybe some of that stuff isn't true.
Wow. You know, it's like we're just on shifting sand. You know, write everything in pencil. We're going to have to bring pencils back. We're going to need the erasers, I think. We've got to take a quick break. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
In the town where I was raised, the clock ticks and the cattle graze. Time passed with amazing grace back where I come from. You can lie on a riverbank, paint your name on a water tank, discount all the beers you drank back where I come from.
Sometimes I want to light up underneath the no-smoking sign. Sometimes I wish they'd tell me how justice got so blind. I wish they'd just leave me alone, 'cause I'm doing all right. You can take your change on down the road and leave me here with mine. 'Cause that ain't my America, that ain't this country.
Figured Lyndon Johnson would have liked Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah.
They would have been kindred spirits, perhaps.
Dr. Pry, you know, speaking of Russia and the relationship we had back then, how would you compare that to where we are today? I mean, it seems a little precarious, our current relationship with Russia. Is not in a good place right now. Do you think it's worse now than it was then?
Yes, I think it's worse now than it was then because the strategic balance has shifted so much against us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hatred is still there. There's still an authoritarian/totalitarian system that hates our free system and sees our freedom is an existential threat to them. They see our leadership of the free world as an existential threat to them. And it's they still see the world as a zero-sum game. They don't believe in coexistence. They think there's going to be a winner and a loser, one side living, the other side dead. They want to be the winners. And they have the means to win now. They might have had the means to win, but the military and nuclear balance was much more favorable to us back in the Kennedy days, back in the Cold War days, right through the days of Ronald Reagan, even though in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, they went gangbusters to catch up and then surpass us in intercontinental ballistic missiles, you know, because they realized that the intercontinental balance of power was the ultimate level of destruction, was the most important part of the geopolitical chessboard. Fortunately, throughout the Cold War, we went from, it's not fortunate that we went from superiority to parity, but at least we didn't allow them to achieve the tremendous advantages that they have over us today. And so because they have the means to win, that's you know, that makes us more imperiled. The advantages that that Russia and China together have over us are such that they might be able to win without war. And that's what they're shooting for. And I don't think most Americans are aware about just how close we are to losing the new Cold War without war. It could take a policy change. We're on the verge of making it now, actually. And I don't think most people understand how catastrophic it would be. It could virtually overnight change the global order from one led by the United States to one dominated by them. And I make that distinction because the United States does not dominate the global order. We're a free society and we believe in freedom for our allies. We lead the free world. We don't dominate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will dominate it. And a new global order based on domination by totalitarian systems is not going to be good for us in the short run or the long run. It's going to be catastrophic for us in many ways, you know, not just in terms of the military peril to us, but in terms of the economics and lifestyle and our ability to get the kinds of things we need to survive. In effect, I think we'll find ourselves besieged, you know, the way England was besieged, in not by an active submarine network, you know, sinking our vessels, but by decisions made by China, for example, to cut us off from critical goods that you need to compete technologically, to make goods, to remain an advanced technological society. But I'm getting ahead of myself, and what is the thing that could happen that could lose the new Cold War for us, that could lose, call it World War III without firing a shot? And it is this thing, maybe many of your listeners haven't heard of it. Well, regular listeners to your show probably have, because we must have talked about the nuclear no first use pledge on your show before.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure we have. And this is one of the things under consideration in the nuclear posture review. There have not been many nuclear posture reviews, or the NPR, are really important to the way the United States runs its nuclear deterrent. They're really important. There have not been many of them. I think there have been 5 or 6 in the whole history of our nuclear deterrent, 5 or 6 nuclear posture reviews where we have sat down and really thought seriously about what are we going to do now, you know, in terms of managing our nuclear deterrent. And the nuclear posture review provides the guidelines for how many nuclear weapons are we going to have. What are the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security policy? What is the mix of ICBMs and bombers and submarines and tactical nuclear weapons? And thinks is supposed to think through all that. And what are the policies by which we use or don't use nuclear weapons? And one of the things that has been really critical is the fact that the United States has never signed on to what's called the nuclear no first use pledge. We have never promised our adversaries, that we will not use nuclear weapons first. We've always maintained ambiguity about whether or not we will use nuclear weapons first. The fact that we don't have a nuclear no first use pledge implies that, yeah, we are willing to use nuclear weapons first. And we were during the Cold War. It's what kept the Cold War from becoming a hot war, because the Soviet Union had an overwhelming advantage in conventional weapons right after World War II, all through the Cold War. They had like a 5-to-1 advantage in tanks and a 10-to-1 advantage in artillery, a 3-to-1 advantage in fighter aircraft against us and our NATO allies all combined. But compensating for that was that we had 15,000 tactical nuclear weapons, you know, and we were willing to use them first, you know, and if it escalated to strategic exchange where the homelands were involved, you know, we wouldn't just be using tactical nuclear weapons on battlefields of European NATO, but it would go into a homeland-homeland exchange. And that big gamble, maybe it was a big bluff, but it but the Soviets believed it, and they believed it because we had the forces. You know, we were building the capability, and we had the plans, and we exercised those plans, and it was credible enough that they never threw the cosmic dice and risked the World War III. And so we accomplished something that has almost never been, yeah, I think never been accomplished in history, not just almost, but never been accomplished, where you had two great superpowers head-to-head like that, and one of them disintegrates and loses everything, including its own existence, peacefully, without there being a war. In the past, one side would always try to prevail. I mean, if they saw their strength ebbing, they would roll those cosmic dice. You ended up having a world war or a major war of some kind, and this is true going all the way back, you know, to the Persians and the Greeks, you know, that instead of passively accepting defeat. And that's especially impressive when you consider we were dealing with the Soviet Union, you know, an inhumane, totalitarian monstrosity that was just as bad as Nazi Germany, just as aggressive. But fortunately, their elites feared enough for their own lives that they didn't chance it. And, you know, we were credibly able to threaten their existence enough. And this, the idea, though, you know, the left has been pushing for us to follow China's good example. For example, China still has, and the Soviet Union at one time had the fiction of a no-first-use pledge. They've put that out there, hoping that we would follow their good example and also give a no-first-use pledge, because these totalitarian systems who lie all the time know that their no-first-use pledge would be a lie, and they would not honor it. But we, as a free, law-abiding, we believe in international law, we believe when we give political commitments verbally and or in writing, that we honor them. And so it would be a unilateral constraint on our actions, but no constraint at all on theirs. They knew that, and that's why they put that out. And we knew after the fall of the Soviet Union, when we captured Warsaw Pact nuclear planning documents, that it was a lie. You know, they had, not only did they plan to strike first, they planned to strike first almost from the very beginning of war, massively.
Imagine that, a lie.
Get a nuclear Pearl Harbor.
Hold that thought, Dr. Pryor. We're coming up on the news break here pretty quick. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That dancing girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. Second hour is going to start off a little smoother than the first hour.
Yeah, you're all settled in.
Yeah, we're all situated.
Got all headphones.
Somehow
up
we time traveled through a 5-minute news break. Like it was 20 seconds. So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And my name's Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill, on November 28th, 2021?
Well, on this November 28th, 2021, we have a sponsor, Pape Machinery. Pape Machinery is our local John
Deere. We only say
Deere.
These things so we can hear Travis laughing in the engineering.
Yeah, very distracting. Right in the middle of my bit.
Work with it.
Okay. Yeah, they're our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And if you have any needs, any tractor needs, ag needs, go up and see them or give them a call. They can do it all up there. If it's selling you a new tractor, fixing your old one, getting parts for your ag equipment, they can do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at...
.com.
Papiermachinery.
.com.
There you go. Yeah, you'll remember it now.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm all ready.
Yeah, they pay us for these. Can
I'm
you
ready
believe
for
that?
Next week.
Yeah.
So, I guess I should give the masochism alert.
Uh-oh.
We forgot to do that.
Do tell.
Bill and I have been married 25 years.
God, I forgot it.
I've been giving Bill a hard time for a quarter of a century.
Yeah. And if the truth were known, I would say maybe five of those both of us remembered before it was over. Yeah.
No, that's actually a lie.
That's a lie, isn't it?
I stink at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I saw my favorite meme for Christmas this year. Feel free to steal it. Maybe I should put it online so people can actually cut it and paste it. It's just a black square with white writing that says, instead of presents this year, I'm giving everyone my opinion. Get excited.
It's coming.
It just seems so fitting for this year. And it could go, you know, really either way. Not to be confused with Santa, who's gay in Norway.
Santa has a boyfriend now.
Santa has a boyfriend in Norway.
Through Mrs. Claus to
So the magic of Christmas is now ruined
bank.
For every child in Norway. Boo.
Yeah, boy.
That's worse than telling him he isn't real.
Yeah,
what the heck?
Brokeback Snow Mountain.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Travis liked that one. Don't encourage him.
Yeah.
Marry you for the next 25 years.
Okay.
The
inappropriateness is over now.
Yeah, the inappropriateness has just ended. Except that we should go back to the song we played at the end, you know, the Moonlight and Vodka.
Yeah.
I forgot to preface that. That's, I'm sure, the Bernie Sanders...
honeymoon song.
Honeymoon song.
That's
what reminded me of our anniversary a week late. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Playing the Bernie Sanders honeymoon song. We need a song. Maybe that'll help.
Maybe that'll help.
Yeah, probably not.
Not.
So, Dr. Pry, I'm sorry. We unceremoniously... silenced you right before the hard news break. Sorry about that.
Not at all. I'm sure what you have to say is more interesting here.
You're so kind.
Give him 5 minutes of news to lead up to the buffoonery.
Oh, my gosh. So we were talking about Soviet domination versus what it was during the Cold War.
Yeah, when they were scared of us.
Yeah, I don't think they're scared of us anymore.
Oh, they're not. And they wanted to complete my thought on this nuclear. Why is that so critical? And why might it be that the Biden administration will adopt a nuclear no first use pledge? And that's because, you know, in this nuclear posture review that's coming up in January, that's when it's supposed to be completed. The left, including many leaders in the Democrat Party and many high-ranking members of the Biden administration itself, have been pushing to cut drastically our nuclear deterrent. We've talked before on this show how there are people who want us to shift to a minimum nuclear deterrence posture so that we only have a few hundred nuclear weapons instead of the 1,500 nuclear weapons. Really, we only have 1,400, but we're allowed up to 150 under the new CERT treaty. Some people want us to, there's a powerful movement that wants us to get rid of all of our ICBMs, to take the nukes off of the bombers so that the bombers have no nuclear mission anymore, and to cut the ballistic missile submarines in half so that instead of 14, we have fewer than half, six, you know, future ballistic missile submarines. And the Pentagon is the Department of Defense and most of the responsible people in Washington, unfortunately few of them are working for the Biden administration, are all against that. Saying we need the ICBMs, we need to maintain a nuclear triad of bombers, submarines, and we can't afford to cut down to just a few hundred nuclear weapons, that it could be suicide to do that. And it may be that, and Biden, if the Biden administration disappoints its political base and its supporters in the Senate and the Congress, you know, people like Elizabeth Warren and Representative Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee who writes the defense budget. I mean, these people are really powerful who are wanting these things. And so they have to throw them a bone. They have to do something to make them happy. And, the Pentagon, of course, always wants its its nuclear capabilities, the forces themselves. But even if the Pentagon gets what it wants and the modernization of the triad continues, all of that will be undercut if the Biden administration yields to this argument that, oh, look, the nuclear posture, no first use pledge doesn't cost anybody anything. The no first use pledge doesn't cost anything. It's just words, right? So you're not giving up an ICBM. Wouldn't you rather get your ICBMs, but let us give the no first use pledge? Wouldn't you rather get your strategic bombers? Just let us do the no first use pledge. Isn't that reasonable, right? The way Washington always works on compromise. But if they do that, the whole point of the nuclear deterrent is undermined, you know, because it kills the concept of extended deterrence. You know, it's basically telling our allies they're on their own. The United States is not going to use nuclear weapons to save you from an adversary aggression. You know, only if they go to nukes will we use nukes too, and by then it'll be too late. And Russia and China don't need nukes to conquer our allies. You know, we've had 18 war games that shows that China can take over Taiwan and dominate the South China Sea, and we lose. You know, we've had numerous war games that show that Russia can conquer Ukraine and the frontline NATO states in 72 hours. You know, they don't need nukes to do that. But if we do get in a shooting contest with them, because we've fallen so far behind, both technologically and in terms of numbers, we lose anyway. But at least our allies, you know, will think that and have the hope that that we would be able to come to the rescue with the threat of nuclear weapons. That's what has kept the peace since the end of 1945. You know, the possibility of a nuclear conflict. You know, and that has successfully every year, you know, deterred our adversaries from rolling those cosmic dice that we keep talking about,
right,
and launching a World War III. But if we rescind that no first use pledge, in effect, that will change the world order overnight to one dominated by Russia and China. The United States could no longer pretend to be the leader of the free world. All of that is underwritten by our ambiguity. It's not even a first use pledge. We haven't promised we're going to use nuclear weapons first, but it's the possibility of keeping that option open. And we do plan for it. We have planned for it. In the Cold War, we've exercised it. All of that would stop in the context of a no first use pledge. And so that's how close we are. I mean, this is my long-winded answer to your short question about where are we relative to those days. That's how bad off we are.
Well, what?
I mean, we weren't anywhere near losing the Cold War during any point from Kennedy to Reagan as we are today, where we're basically one misstep away. And it's not a misstep even involving weapon systems. It's just a policy statement, you know, the no first use pledge. If that is canceled and we give a nuclear no first use pledge, I think that would basically amount to a surrender. It would amount to an American surrender in the new Cold War without a shot being fired. You know, saying, you know, we're just not willing to take the risk anymore. You guys, your allies, you're on your own. You know, you can't count on the United States to defend you. I mean, that's why we're the leader of the free world. You know, because we provide that umbrella of security to protect our allies, which would then disappear with a stroke of a pen or a statement from the president.
Right.
And that's how close we are to losing everything.
Well, having run these war games and coming out on the short end of it every time, you know, Russia and China, you know, have those same results. What do you think is holding them back from a non-nuclear confrontation?
Well, two things. You know, first, we're in national security freefall. You know, every day under this administration, things get worse and worse for us. You know, we still haven't passed the National Defense Authorization Act for this year.
Right.
You know, it hasn't even been passed. There are big consequences for that in terms of our military readiness. That's not a small thing. I talked about the nuclear posture review at some length here about what could happen in the nuclear posture review. You know, I described a happy outcome, you know, where the Pentagon gets everything it's asking for. That's not sure to happen by any means. It's really possible that the Biden administration might decide to ban U.S. ICBMs and give the left everything it wants. Why shouldn't it? I mean, they're their political base. They've been agitating and wanting those things for years. They might get everything they're asking for plus the nuclear no first use pledge, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and if I were on the general staffs of Russia and China, I'd want to wait and see. Is the United States really going to be that stupid? You know, are they going to give up their ICBMs? Are they going to denuclearize their bombers? Are they going to cut their ballistic missile force in half? I'm not going to go to World War III until I find out whether they're going to do that, especially since it's a really good chance that we will do that, in addition to a nuclear no-first-use pledge if we do that. So we haven't hit rock bottom yet. We're still in a national security free fall, and I think they would hold off a decision on aggression until they see just how bad does it get on the U.S. side.
Well, that makes sense.
And this doesn't even count the domestic disruption and I mean, just over the Thanksgiving weekend, we took the statue of Thomas Jefferson out of New York City Hall, right? So the revolution continues within the United States that is extremely divisive and weakens us as a credible adversary in a future conflict. Inflation is eating away at our strength. So in addition to these substantial, obvious military factors, you've got all these soft power issues that are going on where our soft power gets less and less every day. How much more damage can an idiot like General Miley do to our military with this search for white supremacists in our ranks? We've got officers resigning in droves, being driven out of the military, some of our best people. You know, that's still happening. And then, so that's one factor. But the other factor, of course, is, you know, Russia and China both would rather win without war. They're so close to being able to achieve that. All we have to do is just one policy misstep, like this nuclear no first use pledge.
Sure.
Or another Afghanistan somewhere, maybe over Taiwan, you know, where a country, or Ukraine, you know, it might happen tomorrow. Maybe Russia's getting ready to do it now. I might be mistaken about them wanting to wait. Putin made a speech over the summer that basically amounts to a justification for Russia annexing all of Ukraine. I suspect they wouldn't stop at Ukraine. They would probably go after the NATO frontline states. I can't remember if we talked about it on the show before, but we had this unprecedented situation. I mean, this is the second time in 1 year that Russia has mobilized enough forces on the Ukrainian border.
Hold that thought, Dr. Pry, before we get started, so I don't have to interrupt you. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back because we do need to hear more about that. That is kind of being downplayed.
Yeah, that's the hot spot right now.
And I also found the theme song for the Biden's security policy. Believe it or not, I had it right in my playlist.
Really?
I'm not kidding you. And then the song they're probably piping in for, you know, General Miley and his friends.
Yeah.
So anyway, I found a couple of good ones for
you. All right, we'll be right back.
Yeah, you're listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Just a little.
another Biden foreign policy hit. I was really tempted. There were so many things. You know, the Tubes wrote a great song called I Don't Want to Wait Anymore. You know, I was thinking about that one. There were a lot of options there. But Magic.
What was the great song you had about some KGB woman or something?
earlier. Moonlight and Vodka.
Yeah, Moonlight and Vodka. It actually brought back memories, you know, about my own James Bond moment. hardly that, but it did bring back memories.
It was pretty classic, though. You know, I think she's looking at me. It's like, well, and then, you know, we have all the, you know, Eric Swalwell jokes, but that wasn't in Russia. I've got to find the Chinese version.
Yeah.
Preferably something that rhymes with Fang Fang. Yeah, there's a lot of good spy songs out there. But honestly, the Biden administration seems to think that all the, you know, foreign policy and all our strategy and how this stuff is done is with magic. I don't.
Well, I think he just has no understanding of foreign policy.
Well, who was it that said that everything he ever was it Gates that said that every decision he ever made was wrong?
Yeah, foreign policy
on foreign policy.
Yeah.
And look at his advisors. I mean, you take our new Deputy Secretary of State, you know. Oftentimes, the Secretary of State is kind of a figurehead, you know.
Yeah.
Not always the case, but often the case, you know, where they haven't really been a person who's been steeped. But usually, the next person below, the deputy, is supposed to really know what they're doing, you know. But we've got Wendy Sherman as our Deputy Secretary of State. You know, and who is Wendy Sherman?
Yeah.
Well, she was a friend of, during the Clinton administration. You know, she's never had any training, you know, in international security or strategic studies. You know, she's trained as a social worker. She was a social worker.
Oh.
And she was the head of the Office of Child Welfare in Maryland. She was the director of Emily's List, you know, which is an organization designed to get feminists who support abortion elected to office. And that made her a big friend of Hillary. And so Hillary brought her into the Clinton administration. And, you know, she got a big job in the State Department. And she was, you know, one of her first, you know, roles was to author the agreed framework with North Korea, you know, which basically made a nuclear North Korea irreversible. Then they brought her back during the Obama administration. And she was one of the authors of the Joint Conference Plan of Action, you know, the Iran nuclear deal, okay? So two of the worst foreign policy disasters we've ever had, you know, can be laid at Wendy Sherman's feet. And now she's the Deputy Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And she's been entrusted in our strategic stability dialogue with Russia, where we're making all kinds of these decisions that we were talking about, you know, should we renew the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, even though Russia's cheating on it? Should we renounce first use as an option and have a no first use pledge? Should we freeze our ballistic missile defenses and promise never to deploy an SDI? All these things are on the table, and more. Wendy Sherman, who knows nothing about it, has a proven track record of being a complete incompetent. But she's the one.
Well, she worked with John Kerry and was
not just Biden, but his whole team.
Well, she apparently worked with Kerry and was one of the lead negotiators on the Iran nuclear deal. So, you know, she's got that.
Exactly. And, you know, his whole team, Anthony Blinken is a novelist, you know, his whole team is. But then again, these people have been schooled by the new left. They really believe in this, that America is institutionally evil, that we're chiefly responsible for the Cold War and for all the bad things that have happened in the world, and that you can, if only, you know, we will back off and give the Russians and Chinese what they want and respect them as equal powers, and you know, that the world will be in a better place. The same philosophy that the Obama administration had, a new left view of the world, the kind of view that the Harvard International Relations faculty has of the United States, which is extremely negative, and thinks that our fears, the things we've been talking about today, are paranoid fantasies of the right, and you know, that can be dismissed, you know, because we are we're really the source of the problem, and so that's why they seem so blasé about all this. And we were talking about the situation with Ukraine, you know, the second time this year, the second time in 1 year that Ukraine has become a crisis. Maybe the Western press is playing it down. It isn't being played down in NATO. They're absolutely terrified in NATO and Europe and what they're saying in the Western press about what the Russians might do. Because, I mean, I could be wrong. We talked in the previous segment about why haven't the Russians, why haven't the bad guys acted yet, okay? Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. They might not wait. You know, the Biden administration is such a tempting target, they might decide to act. And one of the likely places, most likely places they could act would be against Ukraine and maybe against the NATO frontline states. You know, Russia can overrun Ukraine in 10 hours. And we've had something happen there in this second crisis that has never happened before, which is Lukashenko, who's the dictator of Belarus. It's the country on the other side of Ukraine, and it's between Ukraine and Poland and the NATO states in the Baltic. But Lukashenko has requested that the Russian general staff send nuclear Iskander missiles to Belarus so that they can be put on the border facing Poland and the Baltic states and the Czech Republic and Slovakia. All of these are frontline NATO states. You can be sure that the Lukashenko is just, you know, they're basically Belarus belong, supposedly it's independent, but Lukashenko is a puppet. He's a puppet. You know, he does whatever Moscow wants him to do. And, you can be sure that they told Lukashenko to make that request.
Which is fairly frightening. I mean, if they're going to.
It's a public request. So they're signaling us that they're willing to go to nuclear war by putting nuclear Iskanders opposite our NATO allies. And so this is a significant nuclear escalation in the threat not only to Ukraine, but to the NATO frontline states. And, who knows? They might deliver on those threats tomorrow, and I could be wrong about their being willing to wait. Maybe it's just so tempting, you know, because this administration is so incompetent and does nothing but talk. I mean, we have done nothing to reinforce Ukraine. Not that there's much we could do. You know, the fact of the matter is, we will be hard pressed even to defend. That's an exaggeration. We can't defend even the NATO frontline states, let alone Ukraine. Our own war games show the Russians rolling over us there. That was something I warned about. Maybe I talked about that in a previous show, or maybe it was a different radio interview. But when I was on the House Armed Services Committee staff, you know, I was responsible for. They sent me to the NATO frontline states, these countries before they became into NATO. All the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, and to meet with their military, to meet with their political leaders, to come back and make my assessment about should we expand NATO. And my recommendation to the chairman was that we should not expand NATO to the east. We can't defend it, and it would be giving these countries false hope. You know, there's also an old saying. Maybe it's a Russian saying that you should never commit for a nuclear war for a country that you can't find on the map. And, very hard to justify to the American people that suddenly we have a nuclear guarantee, you know, to defend some place like Latvia, but that's what we have. And so, unfortunately, I remember talking when it was the late great chairman Floyd Spence. He's not around anymore, but he agreed with me when I laid made the case to him, and it's not a hard case to make. You know, we were hard pressed to defend NATO before it expanded, and we were on the defensive. Okay, we would be on the defensive hold off that 5-to-1 superiority in tanks and all the rest. To defend the NATO frontline states, we have to go on the offensive and project power into Eastern Europe, you know, which is something we've never done before. That territory, the Russians know it like the back of their hand. When they were the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, they exercised all over that area, you know, and not to mention the huge superiority in troops and tanks and tactical nuclear weapons that they have in that part of the world. But I guess people thought the new Cold War, the Cold War was over, that it was done during a period when books like The End of History were out, you know, and that the whole world was going to be coming to follow the American example and become free and democratic, and the handful of tyrannies, like what was left of Russia, what was left of the Soviet Union, was going to wither away and go away. And so people thought that we would not have a new Cold War, and that there was no risk in expanding into those countries. But that judgment turned out to be wrong. So anyway, that's where we are.
Yeah, and you know, on the flip side of that, we also have China and Taiwan threatening. So you know, I'm not sure the United States is really in any kind of position to defend any of these countries, are we?
No, we're not. We lose, and Russia and China, I think it might finally be sinking into Washington's head. Something that we've talked about on the show before, I'm sure, is that Russia and China are allies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the new bloc that we face is far more formidable than the USSR and the Warsaw Pact. You know, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And Iran is the world's leading sponsor of international terrorists, because, so that includes international terrorism. All these forces are on one side, arrayed against us. And they coordinate, they help each other. Russia and China support Iran's nuclear and missile program. They support North Korea's nuclear missile program. They coordinate their activities. You know, the Pentagon admits that we'd be hard-pressed to fight in just one theater. Well, we wouldn't be fighting in one theater. If we get into a World War III, it's going to be a multi-theater war. You know, there will be aggression by Russia against NATO. There'll be aggression by China against Taiwan and the South China Sea, and probably against Japan and the Philippines. And there'll be aggression in the Middle East from Iran, and probably against South Korea, and probably Japan, too, from North Korea. So, we can't deal with just one theater, and our war games show us losing in the one theater, and against either of the great powers, the superpowers, China or Russia. So yeah, it's a real
You would
dilemma.
Think that would be a wake-up call.
And maybe the so-called American century, okay, it hasn't even been a century since 1945. This was supposed to be our century, okay, but maybe it's ending prematurely. You know, the case for America going into an isolationistic posture where we basically say, look, you guys are on your own, you know. Some conservatives, more and more conservatives, are talking about that and talking about transferring nuclear weapons to Taiwan and our allies and saying, look, it's not credible for us, you know, to go to war with Russia or China in a nuclear conflict to save you, but it'll be credible if you have the nuclear capabilities. You know, for years, that was one of the objectives, too, of the first use of not having a no first use pledge. It was a chief barrier to nuclear proliferation. You know, we didn't even want our allies proliferating nuclear weapons, building nuclear weapons to defend themselves, because we were afraid that would make nuclear weapons more widespread. I never agreed with that personally. You know, I always thought that if they're on our side, you know, let them arm themselves, including with nuclear weapons. It would make deterrence more credible. But I think that it's too late to do that now, to do it credibly. I think that when Japan and Taiwan and Germany do the calculations, if we were suddenly to say, hey, you're on your own, we're pulling out of NATO, we're going into a fortress America posture, you know, you think of the politics of a place like Japan or Germany, they have a problem that's with their left that's just as big as the problem we have in this country with our left. They have, especially in Japan and Germany, you know, anti-nuclear movements that are just as strong, if not stronger, than ours. And the political leaders of those countries, when they say, you know, we're going to be on our own, do we really want to take the risk, you know, of being targeted by Russia and have to go through the hassle and all the expense of being an independent nuclear power? It's easier to just reach an accommodation, you know, declare ourselves neutral, which in effect is declaring themselves satellites to these totalitarian powers. And that's how you also win World War III without firing a shot, and which is what the outcome that Russia and China are hoping for. So, and to those who are listening, and among people that would probably include my wife, okay, because she's all for isolationism, you know, people shouldn't think of that as being some kind of a magical solution to our problem. These are totalitarian states they're dealing with. It'll be a solution to our problem for a time while they consolidate their control over the rest of the world. But sooner or later, they will organize the rest of the world to come after us.
Yep.
And we will be much weaker than we are today.
Because nobody's going to join with us again. We ditched them the first time. You only get to ditch everybody once. I don't think. I think the second time you wade in and go, no, let's be special friends. I don't think they buy that. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You can find everything about the show, archives and commercial free archives and free to listen to archives at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory. And awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the great compromise.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. We'll sing a victory tune and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horse.
In case you thought it was going to turn out bad, that's the scenario I have planned.
Yeah, that's right. We'll fire up them horses. Dr. Pry, hey, before we run out of time, can you talk a little bit about the Poseidon? I think that's, I don't think we've mentioned that on previous shows.
No, and obviously we're going to do Molly Hemingway's book Rigged on a different show, so you might as well just like,
yeah,
you know,
we don't have time.
No, look at your calendar and we'll hostage you another weekend.
About that. Sorry about that.
It's okay, we did too.
Yeah. Let me quickly mention Poseidon and then, all right. We could do a whole show on that.
Oh, yeah.
That's a Russian, a new Russian so-called doomsday machine. It's the first artificially intelligent nuclear weapon ever deployed, the most powerful nuclear weapon ever deployed. It'll probably have a selectable yield ranging from 2 megatons, possibly up to 200 megatons, according to open Russian sources. The yield most often given for it is 100 megatons. I mean, that's 10,000 times more powerful. 10,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb.
Jeez.
And it's advertised as it's nuclear powered, so that it can basically roam around in the oceans for months or years. And it has no men on board. You know, again, it's artificially intelligent. It's variously referred to as an autonomous submarine. More often as an autonomous torpedo, but it's the size of a small drone submarine, and its official purpose, the purpose they've talked about it most often, is to be a doomsday machine. The weapon would be detonated off the east and west coasts of the United States, which is where most of our population is located, and raise a radioactive tsunami 100 meters high. A weapon of that yield could make a tsunami 100 meters high to inundate the east and west coast with radioactivity to make those areas uninhabitable. Now, possibly it could theoretically be used for that, but I'm very skeptical that that's the real purpose of Poseidon. Because they can, if they want to take out the American population, they have other means of doing that. They could just make direct hits on the cities and use, you know, regular nuclear attacks to nuke the cities instead of going through such an elaborate system as using a radioactive tsunami. I think that Poseidon, I've written a report on this that's available, Poseidon, Russia's new doomsday machine. You know, that the purpose is to track our ballistic missile submarines. The thing they couldn't achieve during the Cold War, they achieved the ability to destroy our ICBMs in their silos. They could destroy our bombers on their bases, so they could get two of the three triad legs. They could destroy the ballistic missile submarines in port. Most of our submarines in a surprise attack would be in port. You know, today we have about 14 ballistic missile submarines. Two of them are in long-term overhaul, so we really have 12. On a day-to-day basis, we've got about four at sea, four submarines. And that's what would survive a first strike. They would probably not survive from a system perspective because the EMP would cut them off from Washington so that we couldn't get emergency action messages to them. But the Russians are very conservative military planners, and they don't want just a system kill. They would like a hard kill of the boat themselves. And I think that's what Poseidon is about. You know, they're deploying enough of these so that they could put two Poseidons against every U.S. submarine at sea, plus one against the ballistic missile submarines of France and England. You know, a 100 megaton warhead will make a huge underwater shockwave. You know, you could be more than 100 miles away, and the shockwave would still kill the submarine. And it's an artificially intelligent thing, so it's probably programmed for the various noises, you know, the signatures, the sonic signatures of our various ballistic missile submarines and nuclear-powered, so it can tail them, you know, get it, tail them all the time until they're ready, you know, and then they would give a signal and take those ballistic missile submarines out. That's what Poseidon is about. I wanted to end because I was intrigued in hearing Aaron's introduction about things people can do to fight back against our growing tyranny. And I want to second the motion on that and suggest that in addition to visiting websites, that people get more aggressive at becoming heroes in a second American Revolution. There must be a lot of young people who don't have jobs, who are at home with nothing to do but play games. I would suggest that you get involved in the real game of life and the future of this republic and do things like, one of the things we need to fight back on the conservative side is we need to start shunning and socially embarrassing our adversaries the way they have to conservatives. You know, the left-wing mainstream media is constantly mocking and belittling us. You know, we should do the same thing to them. And it can be done on a local basis. You know, who's on the school boards? Who are the Marxists on the school boards? Who are the local politicians in city government, county government? Find out who they are. Dig up the truth about them. You know, publish that truth, publicize that truth, even if it's by word of mouth, you know. You know, in Florida, some gentleman recently opened up a restaurant that refuses to serve anyone who voted for Biden. Biden supporters are not welcome. It's actually advertised.
Wow.
A lot of restaurateurs, everybody who believes in freedom should be doing that. Let's make life hard for them. They're used to being on their high horses and looking down their noses at us all the time. I wonder how robust and strong they are to stand up to that same kind of humiliation, which they richly deserve that ostracization from society, that shunning by their fellow Americans. Maybe that's what's necessary to deter them from engaging in tyrannical tactics against us. We're always playing by Christian rules, you know. We're always turning the other cheek, I think, to the detriment of freedom. So I would encourage much more aggressive tactics, including at the local, at the starting at the local level. It's something everybody can do.
Well, it's funny. At church, there's the way the pews are all set up on the far right, there's some short ones. There's a row of short ones from the back to the front. And during the whole virus hysteria, after they finally opened church again, they had these kind of like ropes. So they roped off every other pew, you know, so people couldn't be near each other. Well, for some reason, over on that far right side, those ropes are still up. Every other pew is roped up. And so 9 times out of 10, we go in. We always sit on that side. And I go in, flip the rope off, and sit in the one that's roped off.
Good
and,
for you.
And it was pretty funny because when Mass got over this morning, the lady in front of me, she turns around. She goes, "I just love it when you take those ropes off."
Yeah.
And
that.
I was kind of laughing. I thought, well, you know, let's go. I mean, obviously, that's not going to start a revolution or anything, but it's so weird. I mean, Jesus was right. You know, we are the sheep. Anybody who's ever raised sheep, you can keep them in a field with dental floss. I mean, you don't need a real fence. They're terrified of everything. They'll never run away or try to get out or push on the gate or, God, you're lucky if you can get them to eat. They're scared of everything. You know, goats, on the other hand, are, you know, chewing their way out of everything and tunneling, and they've got plans. I don't know what they're out there doing, but, you know, bad things. You got to be serious if you want to have goats. But we keep acting like the sheep. And we got to stop doing that. It's just ridiculous.
Yes.
I always people say, "Oh, well, this is the end." You know, we're in the end times or whatever. And I'm like, look, I figure it's the end times when there are no more good jokes left. When they put out a variant that spells moronic, when you switch the letters around, and
right.
Nobody makes fun of that, nobody posts that on Twitter, nobody thinks that's amusing. We're doomed. So keep checking.
Right.
You know, the humor will save us.
Yeah, humor can save us. Humor can be a revolutionary tool. They've been using it, trying to use it, against people of conservative views.
They just suck at it.
Culture wars forever. We need to start doing it. You know, you can be a revolutionary just by buying a politically incorrect T-shirt and being brave enough to wear it. You know?
Oh, like Bill's trans-vaccinated shirt? I don't think you were on the week that Bill learned about the transvaccinated shirt. That that I think is funny. You Bill, you want to tell him what the shirt in your mind says?
It's got big and bold across the front. It says transvaccinated, and then in smaller print below it, it says I'm not vaccinated, but I identify as somebody who is vaccinated.
Oh, that's good.
So, yeah, wear that in a crowd.
Yeah,
you can pick them out pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of humor to be had, and it doesn't necessarily have to harm anyone. But I think people are losing their sense of humor. And when you do that, you're not limber in your mind anymore. You know, the fear starts to creep in. And honestly, I think they've been really, I think they've overplayed their hand with the fear, because now people hear, you know, there's a new variant or whatever. And of course, all the jokes are, we're going to have to start using the Klingon alphabet because we're going to run out of Greek letters. But I don't know. I mean, it's time to stop. We don't have to rip anybody's mask off their face, although that's just so tempting.
Tempting to do it.
Yes, so tempting.
Right. The founders did not write the Constitution for sheep.
Right.
In fact, they knew that if the people behaved like sheep, they would lose their freedoms. That's why Franklin at the Philadelphia Convention, the Constitutional Convention, said, you know, we've given you a republic, madam, if you can keep it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can keep it. Well, it's up us to up to keep it now. With humor, or with by more assertive means, if necessary.
Yeah, well, do something productive, obviously. But while you're doing that, don't miss the opportunity to remind people that you know, some of this stuff is absurd, obviously. And as long as they don't see it as absurd, they'll follow it.
I know. That's why they need to be embarrassed. That's why they need to be, you know, verbally knocked up alongside of the head, you know, to be brought back into reality, to be exposed to other opinions that say, look, we don't agree with you at all. You're not right about this. The science, you are not following the science. You're living in a fantasy world, a bubble, and we don't respect that, you know. And yeah. I think it's way past time to find out who's in our schools, you know, that are pushing critical race theory, for example, and putting a spotlight on those people, you know, and judges, you know, who let criminals out or who have politically skewed views on these things. They need to start paying a price, you know, starting at a local level, which is what, you know, is the only reach that most people have. But we need to reach.
Exactly.
You know, the Constitutional Republic was for eagles. Eagles have talons and beaks.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And independence. I mean, they're not a flock bird.
Right. Yes.
It's, you know, and the other thing, too, is we just, you know, while we talk about all the voter problems and all those things that go on, we have to keep reminding people they still have to vote. We had 450,000 people in California, Republicans, who didn't vote.
That's another conversation about whether.
Yeah, we could have tossed Gavin Newsom without that.
I don't want to discourage anybody from voting.
No.
They should vote. But I don't have high confidence that we're going to be able to turn this around. I mean, that's the topic for the Molly Hemingway book when
yes.
you read it.
You pick that date.
I do not have high confidence
send
just
it
because
to me.
We won in Virginia. All right.
All right. We have to jump out. They're going to cut us off here. So we're terribly
okay.
sorry. We will get back with you on the rigged. We want to hear your thoughts on that. So shoot me a date. You've been listening to We the People. Our guest has been Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.